You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jock Parrish, Coder Eat the State. How are you?
Good, although I can hear all those knobs turning off out there now. It's like, oh, Maria's not there again. Darn.
They're going, what's going on? Where's Maria?
Yeah, well, she had a knock at her doorway last night, and no. no, she woke up this morning with a screaming migraine, and so she's home, and we hope she feels better soon, but she threatened that if she came in, she'd probably just throw up on the air, and we wouldn't want that. I mean, you know.
Because, technically that wouldn't actually go out. It would just kind of stop at you and me.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we'd bear the burden of that one. And frankly, you know, with Bush and Rumsfeld getting so much airtime these days, people are probably exposed to, you know, too much of an incitement to nausea from their media outlets already. Mm-hmm. So here we are. I thought that was an interesting segment, the last segment on Counterspin. I actually wrote about a month ago on workingforchange.com, and that's actually the great luxury of that particular outlet, because I get to write about the different things every day, or as, you know, many days during the week as I can churn out copy. And one of the things I wrote about 2 months ago now, I'm sure you could find the search in the archives, was the Bush administration and international financial institutions like Citibank, as long ago as last May, trying to manipulate the stock market there and various other currency exchange and that kind of thing to try and tank the economy, basically as a form of blackmail to threaten the Brazilian people that if you elect Lula as president, you'll be sorry. And it really backlashed. It improved his popularity because a great many people were very angry that, you know, foreigners and particularly global capital in the North were trying to interfere in Brazil's domestic politics. And we've seen this over and over with South America. I mean, other parts of the world too, but it's been particularly noticeable the last couple of years in South America. And because that's you know, our backyard, has James Monroe famously proclaimed, and has been proclaimed pretty consistently ever since. But you know, you had Argentina, you had Bolivia, you had Venezuela, Peru and Ecuador have certainly been in flames. Of course, you have the U.S. military presence in Colombia, and our rather fierce lobbying successfully in that presidential election earlier this year, which hasn't paid off in the war that the Bush administration has been pining for. But if you go back, and I talked briefly last week about the National Security Strategy document that the Bush administration is handing over to Congress, and that the New York Times posted a week ago yesterday on the web, it's in its entirety. If you go to the New York Times and do a search for Bush's National Security Strategy, it'll come up, and unfortunately at this point it's been more than 7 days, so they'll make you pay for it, which is pretty irritating, but I'm sure you can find it somewhere on the web for free. And, you know, if not, probably we should put it up at the ETS website or something like that, because yeah, I certainly have it.
You'd think the White House would put it up.
Yeah, you'd think they'd be
so proud
of
it.
But they haven't reported it to Congress yet. I think it'll be more widely circulated once it's not just leaks that go out, although it was probably leaked by the Bush administration. But in any event, one of the things that comes out of that document is that this is officially to be the foreign policy of the United States. That the United States is not just concerned about weapons of mass destruction or terrorism or freedom or democracy or whatnot, but it is also threatening to intervene militarily if necessary at any time for any reason. But the stated reasons in that document go so far as to talk about, you know, we are going to work to encourage foreign governments to lower their marginal tax rates, essentially the structural adjustment program type regimens that are prescribed by the International Monetary Fund, which is no surprise since the U.S. has the greatest number of votes in determining IMF policy. But it really is a blueprint by which the United States declares its intent to unseat governments, and in this case prevent the election of governments like those in Brazil. It's the declaration of war against the world. And believe it or not, as arrogant as people in the United States, and its government sometimes are, we do not have the resources, and even if we had the resources, we shouldn't be allocating the resources to trying to control the internal affairs of every country in the world, whether it's militarily or otherwise. But this is what we're up against. This is what folks are up against with the demonstrations in D.C. this weekend against the IMF and World Bank annual meetings. And those, you know, the turnout for those demonstrations, not surprisingly, is much smaller than it has been the last couple of years. It's been variously described as a few thousand, certainly not the 20,000 that they were hoping for, and certainly not the kind of crowd that turned out at the first A20 2 years ago. But that's not because the issues have gone away. And in fact, the issues have gained that much more currency and legitimacy, not just because things like the WTO demonstrations in Seattle and the subsequent demonstrations in places like D.C. and Quebec and Genoa and so forth have changed the sort of dynamic and the sort of dialogue around which the IMF and the WTO and these other international institutions make policy. I mean, they're giving lip service to trying to alleviate poverty in a way that they never thought to do 3 years ago. And we saw certainly the agenda at the meetings of the WTO last year, in, or I guess it was earlier this year in Qatar, that there, no, it was last year in Qatar, that even though the developed world pretty much got its way there, they had to work really hard and alienate a lot of people in order to push through an agenda that was very unpopular in the third world. And in general, the leadership, though, in these demonstrations and against the regimen of global capital, basically, there really is a big chunk of the world right now, like most of the third world, that is more or less an open rebellion. If the governments aren't, and in many cases the governments are, but if the governments are not, their constituents often are. And we're really pretty far behind in our awareness of those issues in this country, and our own government in the United States is very much on the wrong side on those issues. We have now officially a foreign policy that says we are going to interfere in the domestic affairs of all of these governments, not just because we think, you know, Saddam Hussein is a madman, we'll get to that in a minute, but also because we want, you find out when the day is over that it's not about weapons of mass destruction or any of these other things. It's about money. You know, it's about the ability to take out resources, to come in and displace indigenous industries and to displace jobs in this country. And, you know, we're seeing that also in our own community with things like the machinist negotiations with Boeing and now with the ILWU lockout, where the welfare of workers in this country is also being directly affected by the imposition of the sort of global rules that are also an infringement on the autonomy of different countries in the rest of the world.
So they like to call it national security, but it's really their own personal financial security that's at risk there.
Oh, very much. In fact, there's a hilarious little disclaimer early on in the national security strategy document that says, you know, America has unprecedented power in this world, but we do not use this power for our unilateral advantage. And, you know, I think actually technically that's true, because it's not America's unilateral advantage at all. You know, most people in this country are disadvantaged by those kind of policies. We've seen people working that much harder for the last two decades for, you know, stagnant wages and less access to health care, less job security, you know, not knowing whether our kids will have a better future than we have. But for, you know, the people sort of at the top of the heap in this country, and for, you know, occasional scattered slices of the upper middle and middle classes that have the little bit of upward mobility that is allowed to us in this country, and once the families like the Bushes, you know, get their share, you know, it's to their advantage, perhaps, at least in the short term, but it's, you know, for the vast majority of people in this country, it is not to our advantage to have these kind of policies. So, yeah, it's not the unilateral advantage of America. It's the unilateral advantage of the people making the decisions and the people who spent the money to get them elected.
The large multinationals.
Yeah. Very much so. Actually, you know, multinational isn't the best term. I think transnational is a better term, because multinational implies a company owes its loyalty to any particular country. You know, it's sort of like a flag of convenience now that somebody says we're based in the United States. I mean, you know, yeah, something might be made in the USA, but it's all its component parts are made in South Korea and the Philippines and Indonesia and Brazil and wherever else. And, you know, they slap a made in USA tag on it for the last 5%. You know, that is the reality anymore, and these companies don't, you know, necessarily pursue policies based on their loyalty to communities in this country any more than any other. If they if you want to see what has been done socially to communities in northern Mexico, where maquiladoras were set up 15 years ago, you know, people flooded to them, worked in abysmal conditions. You have these boom towns created overnight on the edges of places like Ciudad Juarez or Matamoros. And those companies are now picking up and relocating to Southeast Asia or someplace else where they can get even cheaper wages, and the communities have now been decimated. You know, that can happen to a place like Seattle just as easily.
All right. Well, speaking of decimated, let's talk a bit about Iraq and the current administration's continuing to beat the war drums a little louder this week.
Beat is not necessarily the best term for it. And we will get back to the ILWU also, because obviously that's very much in our minds, especially locally. But yeah, it's been a very, very interesting dynamic where the Democratic Party, or at least the leadership of the Democratic Party, people like Tom Daschle and Richard Gephardt, have, you know, it's like they went into their HMO or whatnot, and of course that's a gross, you know, distortion of facts, because they have their own very, very good health care set up in Congress, but not like any of the rest of us. But they went in and got an x-ray and found that they had a spine. I don't understand it. Well, I do understand it, actually. What has been happening over the past couple of 3 weeks, but especially in the last week around Iraq, has been fascinating. It has been essentially that the nation has discovered the peace movement, and the nation has discovered that the arguments that people both on the left and the right have been making for the last 6 months around Iraq really are serious questions. They really do deserve further discussion and further consideration, and the White House is panicking. You would never, even 3 weeks ago, have seen congressional Democrats refusing the White House's efforts. The White House would really like to get a blank check to wage war on Iraq out of a congressional resolution. Anyway, they want the vote next week. That's what President Bush has said, and that's what makes it particularly necessary that people be calling their members of Congress and other people's members of Congress too in the coming days, in the coming weeks, actually this morning, and we'll give the phone number in a minute. But the Congress, and especially the Senate, which has the greater say in this, have already been flooded with phone calls, and they've been 90% opposing the war in Iraq. It's been really unprecedented in recent history, the sheer volume of outpouring of concern from Americans over this issue. And you see polls, you know, the congressional calls is a measure of depth of feeling on an issue. People who are motivated enough to pick up a phone and call, and maybe call again and again and again and again, as listeners to this show should do. But even the you know, the Gallup polls and the various other surveys that are out there that are measuring the responses of people who don't necessarily feel strongly show that there's a lot of concern and a lot of doubt about particularly unilateral action, but really any invasion at all has a lot of unknowns to it, and we've gone over those on this program many times, why it's a very bad idea. You know, I've got that up on the web and Eat the State and at Working for Change for anybody who wants some talking points for arguing with their father-in-law. But, you know, we know a lot of the arguments by now, why it's a bad idea, both militarily, in terms of the future of the Middle East, and we're seeing that also this week with Israel using the war talk in D.C. as a cover for taking attention away from what Israel can do to the Palestinians, and that's, I think, a major reason why Yasser Arafat is under siege once again. But we know all those arguments, but other people don't necessarily. And you would never, ever, even 3 weeks ago, have seen congressional Democrats trying to put off the Bush administration's entreaties to have a quick vote on the resolution. It's like suddenly they're willing to ask questions, whereas even 2 weeks ago, Tom Daschle and Richard Gephardt were on the record as just dismissing out of hand and really sneering at Iraq's offer for unconditional UN inspections. That offer is still on the table, and people in this country, in media and in Congress, are pretending that it never happened. And now you have Bush trying to, you know, push through a resolution that, that demands that there be a military force that that stand by, you know, in case inspection access is denied. And yes, you know, there should be some sort of a mechanism for what is to be done if Iraq does not cooperate, because it has not cooperated in the past. But there should also be a mechanism for what happens if the United States does not cooperate, for what happens, for instance, if it is discovered that the United States once again is using the UNSCOM teams in order to spy, in order to collect intelligence for its own future military use, as happened last time. And that was one of the keys to the dispute in 1998, when the UN pulled the inspection teams out of Iraq prior to U.S. and British bombing, and then they were not allowed back in afterwards because of the allegations, which turned out to be true, that the United States was using the teams for spying. You know, that can, and, you know, Iraq has already put on the table that it's willing to overlook that and let the teams back in unconditionally. But, you know, if you're going to have the enforcement mechanism on the side of, well, we want, you know, we want some sort of a recourse if Iraq doesn't play by the rules, well, it should also be some sort of recourse if the United States does not play by the rules. And frankly, this country has just as much of a track record of not playing by the rules as Saddam Hussein and the government of Iraq do. All that being said, we've got a vote coming up in Congress. I think a resolution will probably pass. It will probably be delayed. It might be watered down. What we saw during the run-up to the Gulf War was, when it looked like the vote would be close, the White House and the Bush senior administration really pulled out all the stops in terms of vote trading, in terms of really pretty much outright bribes. You know, we'll give you your dam and your home state if you give us a vote on this, because it's really important to us. And that's how horse trading is done in Congress. And you'd be surprised how many votes are based on the value of horses rather on actual consideration of whether this is a good bill or a bad bill, or a good resolution or a bad resolution. So I think folks should pull out all the stops to try and lobby members of Congress. We should also give props to Jim McDermott's office. Don't forget to call him. He's in Iraq right now. He has been making very, very good statements on the foolhardiness of this, which really have gone against his party's own leadership up until the last week or so. And that is not something he has a track record of doing. Jim McDermott, one of my main criticisms of him in the past is he's been very willing to criticize war when it's a Republican president and the Democrats have something to gain by it. But when Clinton was doing the bombing, he was, you know, right in the bombardier's seat. But in this case, he's been very critical, even of his own party's leadership, which is his office is to be commended for what he's been saying in recent weeks. Don't forget to make that phone call. But any kind of a movement to stop the war in Iraq should not stop with a congressional vote. It is not a mandate for bombing. What the congressional vote is a way to get this debate some legitimacy in mainstream media and among decision makers, and it buys us some time to organize resistance to this war. And I use the word resistance very pointedly, that it's not just a question of lobbying. It's a question of more actions, like last Wednesday when 12 people were arrested in the lobbies of Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray's offices for demanding that they take a public stand on the war, which they have not yet. You know, other things that can certainly happen to sort of up the ante in this drive. There are a number of events coming up in the coming week around the war. If there is a congressional vote, the Church Council of Greater Seattle has called for a vigil in Green Lake the previous night. Women in Black has had an ongoing vigil downtown at Westlake between 5 and 6 every evening, or every Thursday evening, I'm sorry, and that should be bigger than ever now. Certainly Iraq is one of the main sources of that movement. There is coming up next weekend a couple of very important events. On Saturday evening at 7:30 at United Temple, United Methodist Church, Scott Ritter, the former UNSCOM weapons chief, inspection chief, who has been one of the most outspoken and articulate and in the eyes of mainstream media legitimate critics of war plans, is going to be in town. And I think he'll be all over the media as well. Folks should crowd that place. The TV shots shouldn't be just be shots of Scott Ritter talking. They should be talking shots of thousands of people trying to get in the door and listening on loudspeakers outside. And then the following day, there is a on Sunday, the 6th, next weekend, there will be a large rally. Not My Name is the group that has pulled it together, but even for folks who are skittish and Not My Name, there are an awful lot of other groups that have pulled together and said, we need to put aside our political differences, our ideological differences, and get out on the streets and be visible about this one. So that'll be 1 o'clock at Volunteer Park next Sunday, October 6th, and then marching downtown to Westlake at 3. So all those things are going on. There are coalitions, there are new groups in town that didn't exist a few weeks ago. No War in Iraq coalition, specifically nonviolent one called Sound Nonviolent Opposition to War. I think SNOW is the acronym. A lot of groups out there doing, the justification for SNOW, as I understand, is, you know, it's soft, it's gentle, but it can shut a city down. I really like that.
Okay, because the first thing that came to my mind is snow is falling.
Yeah, there you go. But in any event, there's a movement out there. It's really gaining steam. It's really having an impact. People should call the congressional switchboard and just, you know, put it on your speed dial and keep doing it. It's area code 202-224-3121. There are also a number of groups have 800 numbers that'll connect you to a congressional switchboard. Those come and go, but if you get on Google and just do a search congressional switchboard and 1-800, you can probably come up with a bunch of numbers that do work. I didn't have time to test them all this morning, but the 202 number is the main congressional switchboard. 202-224-3121. And then the best source in town for ongoing events, for an up-to-the-minute, really, calendar of anti-war stuff is Gene Buskin's Peace Calendar. And Gene, incidentally, was one of the people arrested on Wednesday. God bless her. That is www.scn.org/activism/calendar. I'm sorry. So all that information, good for y'all to know.
All right, and people need to remember that the entire Democratic resistance came from people's calls and faxes this last week.
Absolutely. They would never have done it without the congressional, without the public outpouring of opposition.
So
never would have done it.
People need to keep that up. And it can carry over and empower all of us. I know that I felt better after sending off my faxes.
Just the fact that we have already altered the discussion a long, long way from where it was a month ago shows you that there is additional room to give on this one. And there is, I think, even a chance that we could forestall an invasion.
All right, moving along. We only got 5 minutes left. The ILWU is currently locked out on the West Coast.
Yeah, we've been seeing this one coming for a while. In fact, I was standing on the sidewalk in front of the Labor Temple coming out from an event there. A very good event, incidentally. The movie Urban Warrior is out and around, just to give it a quick plug, because I'm in the movie and I shouldn't be, because it's talking about WTO, and I don't think WTO should be as much a focus of the movie as it is, because there's lots of examples of militarization of police. That's only one. The whole militarization of police issue is an example of the war coming home and Bush's national security strategy being used on us as well, as is the ILWU lockout. We have had a dynamic in recent months of the Bush administration threatening to send sailors in as scabs. There have been reports that sailors are down in San Diego training in crane operation and other port jobs in order to come in and replace longshore people should there be a job action, should there be a strike. Well, lo and behold, this morning we have not a strike, but a lockout. The Pacific Maritime Association saying, We don't want to guarantee that that new jobs will be union jobs. And, you know, they're over a barrel a little bit because you can't outsource the port of Seattle to Shanghai, you know, or Singapore or any of these other ports somewhere around the world. You got to do it here. So, you know, it's very hard to take those jobs and say, well, you know, we're paying our dock workers in China only $6 a day, so that's what we're going to pay you. Can't get away with that. And the ILWU has a history of being one of the most organized, one of the most democratic, and one of the most militant groups of labor groups, especially within the AFL-CIO, anywhere in the country. I mean, they were really born out of the general strike in Oakland in 1934 and job actions up here as well. So we have workers both in Tacoma and Seattle locked out until 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, I believe, is the deal. But they're certainly facing the risk of future lockouts as well, and an employer that has had active interference by the Bush administration, you know, saying, we'll say this is a threat to national security, yada yada, and threatening not the Pacific Maritime Association, but the Longshore Workers Union. That is our foreign policy in action. There will be rallies, emergency rallies called today. I've seen conflicting things. There wasn't anything up on the ILWU website as of an hour ago. I know that there is a rally at noon in Tacoma, down on the waterfront. I don't know exactly which pier. I've also heard things about something at Pier 66 here in town today. Again, I don't know the details, but if folks check their web or check their email, probably even as the morning goes on, I'm sure there'll be something going on. So a lot happening right now around town, and a lot of ways in which you know, we need to assert our rights to a democracy in this country. It's a very scary time, but also tremendous opportunity.
All right, just another minute to go, and there is another important thing happening both today and tomorrow relating to the King County Sheriff's Office.
Yeah. Just in case you don't have enough public voicing of your opinions to keep you busy, the inquest into the death of Robert Thomas Sr. is not a dead deal. He is, but the inquest isn't. Sorry for a bad choice of words there. But there is still the opportunity for county prosecutors, this being Norm Mailing, who is unopposed in his reelection bid this year, to file criminal charges against Melvin Miller, the King County Sheriff's deputy who fired the fatal shots. To that end, the NAACP and a number of other very mainstream civil rights organizations in town have been having a daily vigil walking around the block of the King County Courthouse from noon to 1 downtown each day between now and October 4th, the end of this coming week. And tomorrow at, I believe, what, 2:30? Is that the right
time? I believe so, yes, 2:30.
Yeah, 2:30. Also down at the King County Courthouse, there will be a larger march, an opportunity for folks to come down and demand not just charges filed in the murder, let's call it what it was, the murder by an off-duty deputy, of a black man who had the temerity to come into a suburban neighborhood, you know, file charges. He should be held accountable just as any other citizen would be. And it also would send a message in the future to law enforcement officers that off duty or on, they're not above the law. They have to be held to the same standards the rest of us are.
Actually, looking at my notes, I see that's actually at 3 o'clock tomorrow at King County Courthouse for that march and rally. And they'll be going to the to one of the stadiums where they're going to be hoping to get national coverage on
that would be great, so. Because obviously, you know, shooting black people by law enforcement officers who then go scot-free is not just a local problem. It's a huge local problem, but it's also an issue in just about every large city in the country.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time talking this week with Joff Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State, columnist with the Seattle Weekly, and writer at workingforchange.com.
Yeah.
Joff, where can people find you at the State?
Well, it's very funny you say unfortunately every week. And one of these weeks I'm waiting for you to say, fortunately, we're out of time.
Don't worry, that's coming.
But Eat the State is where all this began, and it's still going on. It is a wonderful little biweekly volunteer newspaper. Maria and I and a number of very other good writers, including you. You could write for it also. Not just Mike, but you, the listener. you can find it on the web at www. www.eatthestate.org. It's a free 12-page newspaper that you can find wherever you find free papers around town. You can certainly call us if you have story tips or suggestions, feedback. You would like to volunteer at area code 206-903-9461. And it does cost money to print those papers. And right now, frankly, we need the money once again. So any donations or subscriptions or getting friends to subscribe, you know, a wonderful early holiday present would be a great idea. It's $24 for a year at P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And again, the phone number, if you missed any of that, 903-9461.